from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, Oakland-based writer and performer Echo Brown will join us to talk about her solo show, Black Versions Are Not for Hipsters.
Out here, people think that they're ahead of the curve. So they're super liberal and they're praising the guru, you know, and they're buying their organic foods. But still, there's this kind of undercurrent that happens around race, and I think particularly blackness.
We'll speak with Echo Brown about the power of storytelling and what it's like to personally write about race and sexual violence. Later in the hour, we talk with Bay Area novelist Ron Hanson, who has a new historical novel all about Billy the Kid. Join us for Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Echo Brown had no acting experience when she set out to write her autobiographical solo show, Black Virgins Are Not for Hipsters. But her honesty and sharp sense of humor drew audiences to fill the Bay Area's Marsh Theater for over a year, where her show was extended 7 times. Though the show's premise is light, a giddy Brown is preparing for the arrival of her hipster date. It also delves deeply into her experience as a black woman in America. And we welcome Echo Brown to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I should say, by the way, that this is now, this critically acclaimed show is now at Tribe Oakland, and it'll be there December 15th, 16th, and 18th. And let's talk about the show. I mean, it is begins with that kind of notion of waiting for an online date. That's the frame of it. But boy, you go into so many other things and go deeply. It's really completely autobiographical, too, you've said.
Yeah. So it's based on just so many things that have happened throughout my life. What's interesting about the show is that I initially thought I was going to talk about dating and just talk about the experiences that I've been having out here. But when I started writing the show, all these other kind of past traumas, past life issues started coming up, and I started writing about that. So it became a very different show. So dating is kind of the lens that leads into all these other aspects of my life.
And many lives you've had, many incarnations. Yes. I mean, I was particularly struck by couldn't help thinking about Anna Deavere Smith when you started doing these voices like the guy you were interrogating as a – how'd you become, by the way, how'd you get into that work, investigating police misconduct?
You know, it's interesting. When I was about to graduate from Dartmouth, about 2 weeks before graduation, I was looking for a job. I thought I was going to do Teach for America, but I didn't get accepted for Teach for America, so I had to hurry up and look for something else. And I just found this job as an investigator on monster.com, and it was to investigate the police. And at that time, I thought I was going to save the world. That seemed like the perfect job to do it. I applied, got accepted. And interestingly, the only people, really, that agency is full of young people because those are the only people that really think that you can take on the NYPD. So it's a bunch of young people from college that go into that work.
Why do you suppose Teach for America did not accept you? You would seem to be an ideal
candidate. I know. I to this day have no idea.
You should get an answer from them. I would almost enjoin you to do that or encourage you to do that. So this came out of actually a project you were involved in, this one-woman show you're doing and this monologue you're doing. Talk about that. I mean, that was really the catalyst, wasn't it?
Well, the catalyst for which project?
For your show.
Which project?
For the show that we're talking about. My understanding was that you were actually working with a group that kind of encouraged you to get some of your thoughts down. And
oh, yeah. So it came out of Challenge Day.
That's what
I was
saying.
Yeah. So I worked for an organization called Challenge Day, which is an award-winning organization out here. And we traveled around the country doing these transformational workshops in high schools. And during that work, I had to tell part of my life story. So before that, I had never had any stage experience. I didn't know that I was a really good speaker. But in doing that work and telling part of my life story, I realized I was a really good storyteller. So I started looking for places to do that, to perform, to be on stage. Somebody told me about the Marsh. I started taking a class there in February of 2013 with the great David Ford, and the rest is kind of history.
And it took 2 years, but the rest has become history. David Ford has had, you know, a stellar record. I mean, he's brought so many solo performers to our attention in the work that he's done in collaboration with them. And I'm sure you feel very fortunate to have worked with him, but I'm sure he felt very fortunate to be working with you, too. I mean, you bring out so much of you mentioned traumas before and personal material here, and your own vulnerability comes through and sort of your own spirit comes through, but also a lot about transformation.
I think, you know, I think that's the biggest appeal for the show generally is that people have this transformative experience. So they come in and I'm very light and I provide a lot of humor and they think they're just going to watch this date. And then I start to drop these kinds of emotional bombshells on them. So I talk about my brother being in and out of prison. I talk about the molestation that happened to me when I was younger. And I don't think people are expecting that depth and that emotional catharsis. So it's the combination of the humor, we dance to Beyonce, and the combination of the train and the pain and the exploration of that, that really gives people this transformative, cathartic experience. And there are people that keep coming back. Like I've had a person come up to me and say they saw the show 10 times, which is unbelievable to me. But, you know, there's a real
desire. Pretty
validating,
though. Yeah.
Well, it is, kind of. But I just feel like, I don't know, that's kind of intimidating also.
Well, it shows that there's a lot in the show to get, and there is indeed. I mean, you come from a fairly impoverished background. I know the area you're from in Cleveland, and it's a tough area to have grown up in. In fact, probably first person in your family to go to college, let alone Dartmouth,
Yeah, I'm definitely the first person in my family to go to college. And, you know, my parents and my brother got to see the show when I was in Cleveland. I did it there in at the beginning of this run in early, I think, 2015. And for them, it was such an amazing experience to see me come from the same environment and then see me blossom in stage and be telling our family story. So that, I think, was the crowning moment of the show, was to have them be able to see it. And have this experience of me being on stage in that way. It was really amazing.
Family story, and a lot in that story, as I've been intimating and you've been intimating, that certainly is troubling and comes across in a cathartic way, as you said. You know, you're getting it out. But you're also doing some satire, really, some serious satire about hipsters, especially white hipsters, because that's who the date through Craigslist, no less, is with.
Yes.
And also, there are reminiscences in this work of The Color Purple, at least in my mind, I mean, not only because of the molestation experience you alluded to, but also there's a reality that black men can be, how shall we say, women can be tough on them in terms of dating partners and all the rest. You are.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is that for The Color Purple, I actually talk about The Color Purple in there through the lens of some of the experiences that I had when I was growing up. So being made fun of for being darker skinned, for having African features. That's actually a theme that runs through the show. And Alice Walker actually came to one of the last productions of the show. And thank God I didn't know she was in the audience. Thank God nobody told me. At the end, she raised her hand and she asked a question and she told me that on behalf of the ancestors, we're so proud of you. And it was just such an amazing, like, completion of this whole cycle. I never would have imagined, because that movie had such an impact on me growing up, that I would, you know, be in the presence and have her come witness my art, which was influenced by her art.
Now, what a wonderful feeling that must have been. But let's just take a guess here. Were you also influenced by Toni Morrison's Bluest Eye?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Completely influenced. Maya Angelou, Toni Morrison, yes.
Let me actually bring our callers. This is only a half-hour segment. If you happen to have seen Echo Brown and her show, Black Virgins Are Not for Hipsters, critically acclaimed solo show, which now you can see at Tribe Oakland December 15th, 16th, and 18th. Or if you'd like to talk with her about many of the subjects that are opened up in this dating, difficult, a lot more dating difficulties out here than in New York, as I was talking about with her before we went on the air, but also the portrayal of, you know, the myths of black women as opposed to the realities of black women's lives and so forth, which she really brings to the fore. If you have questions or comments, you can join us now. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Particularly like to hear from any of you who've seen the show who want to comment on it. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. And Alice Walker, if you're listening, feel free to call us or join us also. You can also go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Please feel free to join the program. Like I said, it's a half-hour segment, so now would be the time to call, email, or go to our website. And let's talk about white hipsters here, because you really kind of deconstruct them and disassemble them in many ways. Couldn't help thinking about a famous essay Norman Mailer wrote, The White Negro. It's about white would-be hipsters, but back in another era. But you kind of I mean, it's very funny stuff. You've got really humorous material here with these. These are people who have – these are white guys who have a lot of cash somehow.
Yeah. You know, when I was in New York and I first started dating this person that the show is based around, and I was entering that culture and entering that world, I was very confused because I had actually come from poverty. So I came from, as we have been mentioning, a place that really just was low income, no money. And these folks were saying that they were also poor, but they had – all this money, and they would pay like $5,000 a month for rent. They could, you know, pay $5,000 to build a bike that produces coffee for Burning Man. And so all this was very confusing for me because in reality, they had safety nets. They had access to money. They had access to resources, but they borrowed the narrative of poverty so that they could gain some kind of artistic and social credibility in terms of who they were trying to be in the world or what they were trying to project. And it took me a while to really understand what was happening there.
And the whole sense, again, of black men, I mean, certainly your brother comes off as somebody to admire and respect and like the way you present him and everything. He's had some troubling times in prison, as you or jail, as you indicated, and so forth. But did you get, you know, because Alice Walker did and so many other black women got, you know, kind of pushback. Black men are not necessarily as sympathetic as they ought to be, or they're too, how shall we say, cavalier with black women, that sort of thing?
I got a little bit of pushback, but I think unanimously across the board has been support. So I did the show at Tribe Oakland after Thanksgiving, three shows. I had a lot of black men in the audience that stayed for the Q&A that were really supportive. Because I think, you know, what it comes down to is it's how we condition men. And especially within the black community, it rolls down to black women in a lot of ways, some of these abuses that come out. But across the board, pretty much people have been supportive of the show. And I think there is a need to air it out. I do think that within the black community, we have this desire to kind of keep things closed because we're dealing with so much on the outer levels. But a lot of people have been appreciative that I was willing to go there, that I was willing to discuss these issues and have been overwhelmingly supportive.
You've been getting a lot of praise about your Beyoncé dance?
You know, that's my favorite part to this day of the show. I have the audience dance to Beyoncé. I teach them a couple of famous Beyoncé dances, like the Uh-Oh dance, and they get up and they all dance and they participate. And people love it. Like, they really have a good time and they're really shy. And I see good dancing, I see awful dancing, but people really love that part of the show.
Well, Beyoncé is, you know, an extraordinary woman in so many different ways. But you're talking about more ordinary women like yourself, now extraordinary, perhaps, but certainly ordinary in terms of looking back at your past, not necessarily getting the attention that you wanted, especially for men, all of these kind of dilemmas. But you are going after a lot of the myths about black women in this performance of yours.
Yeah, and that was really important for me to be able to kind of deconstruct this you know, this perception that we have of black women of always having to be strong or always having to be hard or this or unattractive, these things that we project onto them. So I wanted to show a range. And I think that really no black woman is ordinary. That's why we have black woman magic. We call it black girl magic, because it really is something to be a black woman in this society, to be at the very bottom and to have to overcome all these obstacles. You develop this kind of inner strength, but you also have a vulnerability and you also have a soft softness. And I think that's what the show really gets at and why people have been so receptive to it.
You're a great critic of the receptivity and the responses of your audience and what they get out of the show. I mean, because obviously you've talked to a lot of people and gotten a lot of feedback.
You know? Yes.
You know, there have been studies that show that among young women, black women have more self-confidence and more self-esteem than any other race, any other ethnicity?
Well, I believe it. I mean, I think you have to develop this kind of belief in yourself, and you have to develop, you know, this kind of resilience in yourself, because so much of society is trying to break you down or say that you're not beautiful or you're not attractive. So you have to find it in yourself. And when you find it there, of course, it's going to be stronger than if you were finding it outside of yourself.
And a listener named Kevin wants to know who you feel your target audience is.
You know, I actually don't have a target audience. So people ask me that all the time, especially after the show, if I went into this thinking I was writing for a certain group. I wasn't. And the biggest surprise for me was how this show resonated with so many different communities of people. So all kinds of people send me emails. All kinds of people write in and tell me how much they enjoy the show or how much it resonates with them.
It's a great feeling. I mean, you're hitting some universal, obviously, chords here. Let me go to some of our listeners and find out what's on their mind, what they want to ask you or say to you. T is our first caller. T, you're on the air.
Hi. First, I want to say I was able to see the show at the Marsh, and I really felt like it was incredible show, and I'm so proud of the work that you're doing. My question really is, do you feel like the show is received any differently on college campuses in terms of the reaction, the feedback? That's what I was really interested in. Thank you.
Yeah, so I performed the show at a couple local colleges, and generally people are appreciative, but what I've found is that younger audiences, I've also done it for a high school audience, the younger kids aren't ready to digest and kind of take in the material yet. So it kind of goes over their head. So they are an audience that gives less just because they aren't as knowledgeable or receptive to the material as an older audience is. So it's actually a very challenging audience to perform for.
Talking to Echo Brown, writer, actress, and storyteller. And her critically acclaimed solo show is called Black Virgins Are Not for Hipsters. It'll be at Tribe Oakland December 15th, 16th, and 18th. Let me thank T for her call and go to more of your calls. Let me go to Tom. Tom, you're on.
Oh, thank you, Michael. I'm enjoying your show. Actually, a young black virgin suffered terribly recently right in the heart of the high-tech South Bay Fremont. Recently, he was on, I think, about a week ago on ABC News, Israel Howard. He had a huge list of racial harassment cases, mostly name-calling. He had been submitting for apparently several years to his teachers and school board, superintendent, principal, everyone he could think of. And they just completely ignored him, like, you know, just suck it up. That's just normal for this area. In fact, you know, in San Jose, it's only 2% African-American, and they keep it that way on purpose with, the high rents. It's purely designed to keep, you know, black and minority people out. Not only San Jose, but San Francisco and other places where there's been, ethnic cleansing and apartheid. So anyway, this young man is the most promising public speaker I've ever seen. He had the poise of a 50, 60-year-old actor or a politician that sometimes went in the same, of course. So anyway, I think if he gets on stage with you, Echo, you could have the greatest show on earth, from now until he becomes president of the country.
Well, there's a suggestion for a dual performance. Thanks, Tom. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. Tell me about the name Echo.
You know, there's not really a story behind it. My mother said when she was in the hospital, she wanted to name me something really different. Somebody was like, oh, you should name her Echo. And that felt like a name that was different enough that, was appealing to her. But there is a story behind it. She wanted to name me something different. So she set this intention for me before I was born that she didn't want me to live the kind of life that she lived. She didn't want me to go through those same experiences. So I think in the naming of me and searching for something different, that was her commitment and her hope for me not repeating the kind of cycles of poverty and addiction and all those things that have been in my family for generations.
It's also wonderful when you portray your mother and all that talk about men's.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's really, you know, trying to be a source of wisdom and advice to you and also tell you, you know, you got to be a serious student. Avoid these men's. They're just going to be bad for you, pretty much.
Yeah. And she was, you know, I think my mother, more than anybody, body is the reason that I was able to take this trajectory in my life. And it's because she just didn't want me to repeat the same cycles. And particularly, there was so much sexual violence where I grew up, and there was so much violence in that way. And she really tried to protect me from that. And even though ultimately she couldn't, she just was such, she was like my North Star in getting out of that kind of environment. So I'm really grateful for her and for her foresight and for her heavy-handedness now in retrospect, not at the time, because that really was the impetus. That was the what helped me get out of that environment.
She saw the show in Cleveland.
She did.
Yeah, that must have been a thrill for her.
She was so proud. If you look at the pictures I posted to Facebook of my mother and my father, my youngest brother, they just look so proud. They look like they're standing next to Beyonce. because it was such a cathartic and important moment for the family.
Let's actually hear, we have a cut from your performance, and I thought it would be useful for listeners to hear. This is actually, you have a section to read. I'm sorry. This is the one on hipster culture that you're going to read for us, yeah?
Yeah. Even though I really like Ryan, he's got everything I'm looking for. He's hot. He's kind. He cares about social justice. I'm still very concerned about his hipsterness, particularly the fact that all of his friends are hipsters. They seem to have an endless amount of cash, even though they work low-wage jobs at coffee shops and complain about how poor they are. And to be so poor, boy, do they dress nice, like they just walked off the set of Mad Men. I feel out of place amongst them, so I mostly sit quiet and observe while they talk.
Yeah, and that's that lumber sexual appeal. You want to talk about that a bit?
Yeah, I think Cosmo magazine did an article a while back about lumbersexuals. So these are men that kind of take on the appearance, the physical appearance of being a lumberjack, but they don't actually chop wood and they don't actually do anything rugged. They just wear plaid shirts and they may have, thick, bushy beards, and they take on this certain persona of masculinity. And I personally am very attracted to that.
We should mention Ryan is from Portland. So that's a place where you get a lot of lumberjacks,
that
a lot of timber industry and so forth. Let me get to some more of our callers here. And we go next to El Cerrito. Irma, you're on the air.
Hi, Michael. It's pronounced Irma. Hey,
Irma,
Echo.
Sorry.
It's great to hear your voice.
Hi. Thanks for calling in.
Absolutely. And I love the story about your mother giving you a unique name and allowing you to go out and create your own story, which is a beautiful one. I've seen the play twice. I've brought a bunch of friends. I think you talk about really important issues and the work that we need to do to bridge the racial, cultural, social class divide. So I urge everyone to see it. As you say, it's both funny and painful and really very life-affirming. So congratulations on the great work, and I hope folks get to see it.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you. Good to hear from you.
I want to hear from another listener who actually reviewed your show and is calling from up in Oxborough, Massachusetts. Sai, you're on the air.
Oh, Sai.
Echo, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. It's snowing, man. As I was listening to you talk to Michael, I was just thinking of how people come at you and glom onto you from such different angles. The sexual abuse angle, the smart young person angle, the racism angle. We all come at you differently. But you always come out as a whole person, which is why it works so effectively.
Yeah.
And I know the angle that resonated with me was your response to fake liberalism, to hipsterism. And can you distinguish between that and racism at all?
Boy, we're getting quick on time here, but quickly, have some thoughts, Echo?
I'm sorry, can distinguish between, I didn't hear the last word of what you're saying. There's music playing now.
Fake liberalism and racism.
Oh,
in the Bay Area.
Yeah. So, I think that what I've experienced out in the Bay Area is that people are very liberal out here. People, want to believe in...
We're not going to hear the rest of this, unfortunately. We come to the end. Thank you.
Okay.